All right, and we're live. Welcome back to the Loopcast. Today, joined by two very special guests, we're mixing it up. Mercer is out, but we have Catholic Vote President Brian Birch and Kara, who many of you know now and like, wanted back on the program ASAP, so we got her. So, happy tax day. Happy post-masters. Did you guys have a good weekend?
I did, yeah. Watched the Masters yesterday at Top Golf.
Wow, it doesn't get more golf than that.
You get to watch exactly. And play.
Exactly.
And Brian, I understand you were in Rome, right?
I was indeed. So I came back this weekend, so I only got to see the end of the Masters. But I was in Rome all last week. Never a bad place to be. Rome is as great as it always has been. I was there for what they call America Week. A series of events occur usually a week or two after Easter. There is a big dinner put on by the North American College where all the American Cardinals go over. There was a number of other events that I was able to attend, met with a lot of our European allies and talked a little bit about maybe a Catholic Vote Europe. So we'll see. A lot in play. We're expanding our footprint, hopefully maybe around the globe.
Wow. Catholic Vote Europe.
It's, you know, it's interesting because they talk about how much what happens in the United States impacts Europe. I met with a member of European Parliament, the leader of the pro-family movement in the European Parliament, a representative out of Croatia, Ladislav Ilic, a fantastic guy. Tom, you know,
it's my heritage, man.
Croatian.
I am indeed Croatian.
But it's interesting because they talk about this concept of one West and this idea that it's not just the United States, the elections we have, the decisions we're making. But also, obviously, European Parliament has elections this year. And the idea of what we're collectively working toward is trying to both salvage and renew this idea of Western civilization. And you have all these movements, obviously, France and Netherlands, clearly Eastern Europe with Hungary and a lot of even Giorgia Meloni, the prime minister of Italy. There's something afoot here. It's not just some Trump phenomenon in the United States where you have an uprising of sentiment and will for real change against kind of the woke globalist progressive agenda. And we love the opportunity to work with European allies and to tell them what we're doing. In fact, they look to us in the United States as an example of success. Now, whether we have a lot of success or not, but, you know, we intuitively understand kind of grassroots organizing and agitating from the ground up. And Europe doesn't have that tradition, and they're clearly rediscovering that. And they see what we're doing in the United States is a real opportunity for them, and they want to learn from us and just a lot of good things.
This is conjecture, but why do you think Americans are so naturally good at a grassroots approach? I mean, I think the government structure comes to mind, but from their perspective, what did they admire so much?
I think it's kind of obvious that Europe is a, you know, millennium old tradition that was largely built on a very different way of life and how the idea of power and organizing and order comes from, obviously, the Middle Ages and these guilds and such into kind of an aristocratic order, obviously then into the democratic order. But our country was founded on the idea that the people decide. We're consent of the governed. We have elections. The whole formation of our government was one from the ground up, where the people have the power from the start, not the aristocrats, not the king, not the Holy Roman Emperor. So all of the kind of way of life that Europe has, you know, inherited is very different from the American experiment. Now, obviously, most people with modern media in the last 100 years of you know, democracies in Europe, they are learning those ways, but it is a very different experience. We kind of take that for granted as Americans that, hey, we can to actually change things. We can do things. We can go protest and call our legislators. We can issue press releases and videos and go right to the people. We don't have to go influence the back channels of the, you know, palace in order to try to bring about change. Although increasingly so, though it's our palaces, our boardrooms.
Yeah, it's starting to feel like it.
In government buildings. Offices, right. Right,
you know, exactly. Ugly concrete buildings in D.C. sure starting to feel that way. Well, that's really interesting. But speaking of international, so first news item on the docket, we have Iran attacking Israel. So I think it's important to just lay out kind of the facts of what have happened before we start getting into reactions. But at our base, what we know is that the largest unmanned strike sent from Iran soil in history was sent at Israel. So 170 attack drones, 30 plus cruise missiles, 120 plus ballistic missiles. So almost all of these were shot down by Israeli air defense. Pretty minimal damage. I think 99% were shot down from what I heard. But Iran actually announced this attack about an hour before it was sent. So this allowed Israel to get jets up. There's also some international allies helping shoot some of these down. So important to note, seemingly this was in response to Israel sending a drone strike on an Iranian embassy in Syria. This killed two Iranian generals specifically that were involved with that October 7th attack on Israel. And so we're kind of getting the fallout from that now. Interesting looking at domestic reactions for how President Biden has responded to this. Basically, he said, take the win. He is saying we're not going to be a part. The United States is not going to be a part of a counteroffensive. He's saying you defended it. Everything's good. We'll see how Israel responds. It is notable, though, Biden did lift sanctions on the Iran drone program. The same drones were used in this attack. And I think this kind of contributes to what many Americans see as just a broad failure from the Biden administration internationally when it comes to peace and war. I think Biden's approval rating on is doing a good job internationally is at about 33%. And if you look back on Trump's numbers, it was at about 55% is doing a good job internationally. So all that's kind of known at this point. Biden actually called a really early lid on Saturday afternoon, which, I mean, surprise, surprise, he's an old man. But what do you think internationally from an American perspective is going on in the White House, Brian?
There's so many layers of this. And of course, we now view international events like this with skepticism because you're trying to wonder what exactly is going on. And we knew a week ago that Iran was likely to act here. I mean, I remember, I think I told everyone internally on our comms channels that get ready for, you know, further escalation in the Middle East. So it's a little odd to me that if you're going to, you know, shoot some missiles off at someone that you start telling them a week before, then you warn that they're coming, an hour before, and essentially kind of ensured that whatever damage you did wouldn't be so significant that there would be a, you know, proportionate response. Although we'll see, and obviously the test now is what Israel will do, and I think sure there will be some type of surgical action. I mean, the whole politics of it is so crazy because here you have, you know, last year, Anthony Blinken, Biden's national security advisor, saying that the Middle East has never been more stable. Meanwhile, they're dishing billions of dollars to Iran. They turn the Trump policy and start unlocking all these billions of dollars and say we have close, you know, scrutiny on it. This is not going to be misused. It won't be used for military weapons. And lo and behold, all of that was a joke. I think that the real message here is President Biden, who warned us that Trump would lead us into World War III, that he would lead to all this. This instability in the world has done precisely that. We now have war in Eastern Europe, potentially escalating with even a vote this week in the U.S. House, where we may be sending, you know, billions of additional dollars into Ukraine to further provoke Russia. Now you have essentially missiles flying into Israel. There's no question. And one key takeaway here is that Biden has zero control of the situation, and it's could get far worse. What if China decides to take advantage of this and then decides to move? As far as, you know, the conflict there, it's interesting. Iran launches these missiles and then declares a ceasefire. It's almost like what happened when the terrorists attacked Israel in October last year. They do the deed and then say, well, we need a ceasefire now. Well, wait a minute. What about the ceasefire before you chose to act and to attack innocent people? It's kind of a tricky game. And of course, the politics here domestically is that Joe Biden's totally trapped. You know, the joke is he's in favor of a two-state solution, and his two-state solution is Michigan and Minnesota. That's really what he's concerned about. He has a political problem on his hands. The obviously pro-Palestinian, left-wing, anti-colonialism front does not like this. You're seeing protests in the streets. You're seeing protests in St. Patrick's Cathedral over this. I had protesters outside my building the other day, pro-Palestinian protesters. I had quick take to make sure they weren't protesting me. but you know, this movement is real. It's definitely impacting young people, young voter sentiment. I think this is part of the reason why Joe Biden's numbers are so low. And just, you know, generally voters who are looking for better jobs, more affordable housing, food, gas, and stability are not getting it from this president. And so what does he do? He's talking about abortion, which I know we're going to get into, but it's clearly the world's on fire.
I guess it's hard to blame
in multiple ways.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to blame him to want to pivot to abortion when he's got this type of mess. I mean, even if you look at, you mentioned Michigan, Minnesota, in Dearborn, there's out loud chants in the streets, death to America, death to America, death to Israel. You have part of the really progressive base of the Democrat Party basically gunned to Biden's head saying, hey, look, people are not going to vote for you if you take an aggressive stance pro-Israel. It's just not a fun mix to be in.
It's funny because some people, I think, don't quite understand what's going on here. Now, why is the Harvard faculty and young people and, you know, people in the streets so seemingly pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel? And it's not just the question of, you know, whether or not they believe that the Palestinian people have been oppressed by Israel in terms of the specific circumstances of the moment. It also has to do with this larger, actually related to the conversation we just had about Europe a moment ago. And that is, behind all of this is this construct, this kind of Marxist idea that the world consists of oppressors and the oppressed. And the idea that Western man, particularly white man, in this case, Israel, but they also believe this about the United States, took over lands occupied by indigenous people who they claim were there first, so that they just don't look back far enough in Israel, in the Israeli case, that is. But that we impose our ideas, our way of life. And we impose, by the way, the Christian order, not in Israel, of course, but in the United States. But the idea that the West has oppressed people for millennia, and that part of the political program is to upend the entire Western way of life. And don't, you know, forget that what they're saying about Israel, they also believe about the United States. This is all behind this whole woke agenda is to deconstruct all the our norms, our moral code, our reliance upon religion. This idea of the West for them is an impediment to their understanding of where we need to take humanity and take the world. And so it's interesting that these young people have kind of imbibed this kind of Marxist ideology. They're obviously applying it to Israel. But this is a much larger kind of ideological struggle in which this conflict is playing a role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Iran has also been very open about their goal is to totally eradicate Israel. And to your point, probably more than just Israel.
Yeah, because it's funny. Both are a part of the UN and they're kind of told to play nice, but it's actually a part of like Iran's charter that they think Israel should be obliterated. So it's kind of hard to... I think there's an economic element to you mentioned, why would they tip off the strike? I mean, not all strikes are meant to be deadly. Some are just a show of force. I don't think anyone really benefits from a larger war in that region in terms of economics, for sure, with what could potentially happen to Iran.
Trump totally defunded all of the missile and ballistic programs. So they had no money to have an attack.
Well, and what he did to Turkey, too.
Kara's is happening on it, I think. And it's like what everyone kind of knows, but no one wants to say out loud. All of these conflicts, whether it's Ukraine or Israel or lots of different things, COVID before, these are all just massive money-making grifts. I'm sorry. Everyone can see it. This is going to justify huge amounts of new money going to places that we don't know with no accountability for massive weapon systems, for humanitarian aid. I mean, let's face what's going to happen here, both in Ukraine and in Israel. Is we are going to fund both sides. We're funding Iran. We're funding Israel. And Ukraine, we're funding Ukraine. And to go back further enough, there's U.S. money everywhere, just awash, so that we can destroy all of these places. And then the U.S. will be called for to come in and rebuild. Well, who benefits from all that? Mm-hmm. It's all the defense contractors. It's
Brian,
all the humanitarian globalist groups.
Brian, Mitch McConnell said it would bring jobs to Arkansas or Alabama, where they have Lockheed Martin plants or whatever. What would you say to that?
Well, let me just say this. I had a number of meetings while I was in Rome with a lot of the, let's call it, conservative groups involved in Europe. And they attend these meetings around Ukraine and such, where all the Ukrainian kind of advocates are showing showing up in Mercedes Maybachs and Rolls Royces and Bentley cars. And they're all looking around wondering what the heck is going on. This is all, again, a kind of, there's layers of this. There's clearly ethnic and religious conflict and arguments around anti-colonialism and things that we've talked about. But, you know, our betters have found a way to use the massive taxpayer resources that our politicians in Washington are willing to distribute to enrich themselves. And there are a lot of people getting very rich on all of this. And it's one of the reasons I think a lot of the right, particularly under Trump, and what they hate about him is he actually stops the money train. A lot of the right, though, has become very skeptical of America's interventionism. This, you know, we get done with Afghanistan and within a year, we're already at war in Eastern Europe. War. Mm-hmm. It starts to seem like, you know, we're on this kind of hamster wheel of conflict and war that allows the money to keep flowing. And I think we are right as Catholics and not only as kind of skeptical, voters to take a second look at it. What is this kind of posture that we have as America to be the policeman of the world? And how is this really working out for us right now?
Mm-hmm. It's such an odd psyop. Like there's people on the Catholic left that are like so anti-death penalty, but then are actively cheering for us to go abroad to war all the time. Ukraine, Israel, Palestine. They want us, our weapons there. They want people there. It's crazy how that shift has kind of happened in politics from maybe Democrats being the let's get out of Vietnam protest to now Democrats being like, no, we need to send all our money and weapons and even people over to Ukraine to go fight foreign wars all the time. It's crazy that shift happened like overnight.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, especially the Catholic left. Yeah. I mean, the Catholic left has been so hostile to, you know, money for weapon systems, nuclear arms, and obviously, particularly under Reagan, put up this huge fight against, efforts to keep Russia in check. And you can make the prudential argument that, yeah, there was a lot of grift back then, too. But this was a necessary and real threat where Russia was talking about, you know, conquest and bringing communism around the globe. I think that's a very different situation than today. And I think the experience of the last 20 years and perpetual conflict, trillions of dollars of our treasure and the lives of our own citizens, the Catholic left, unfortunately, I think, has now taken kind of the old neocon position, which is by any means necessary and by any cost necessary, that every foreign conflict is now justified and moral. And, I think the tables have flipped and we'll see who's right.
And yet it's crazy because our southern border is a total mess with women and children getting raped and killed. Yeah. And we've got quite the...
Sounds a little America first, Kara. You might want to cool your jets there. That's not acceptable to talk about in Catholic circles at
this time. Policemen of the world, not our own border.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, we're police Ukraine's border, but
exactly. We sent earmarked money over to Ukraine for their border security. It's just like, you can't make this stuff up. That could even be Twilight Zone itself. But we need a little palate cleanser here. So it's going to be interesting to see all the international stuff played out. But I don't know. We got some golf fans on this podcast. Were you guys tuning into the Masters over the weekend?
Oh, yeah.
Watched the final round, but kind of knew how it was going to play out. I mean, Scheffler he's the cool, never makes a mistake. He just knew how it was going to go. Everyone was going to fall away. No kind of back nine fall apart. Scotty Scheffler, it's like, doesn't happen.
Did you guys see the Tiger meme that was going around? He was shaking someone's hand behind the tree, and it looks like he's shaking the tree's hand.
Yeah.
So funny.
That was hilarious. Did he like hit the tree?
I was confused. I thought that was like his like Vern Lundquist kind of, last, broadcast by the famed, CBS announcer who called all these like, wonderful Tiger shots. So maybe I was confused. Was that related or was that just kind of a fun Tiger shaking the tree's hand?
I think it's because he hit the tree previously in one of the Masters. And so it was like him apologizing to the tree. Like they had finally like made up because it was just a random fan handshake behind the tree. So, but yeah,
I love that a lot of people.
I did see that he hit someone.
Yeah. I think so. Go ahead, Brian. What was that?
No, I was going to say, it's always kind of funny because a lot of people, at least maybe it's my kids, were thinking, well, Tiger's only 15 shots back, but he's still in it. Even though there was like five holes to play, that somehow Tiger in a red shirt can always pull it off. So just make sure we, you know,
for sure,
watch the Magic.
I think, is he the one that has, he's qualified 24, the most that anyone ever has? Is that right? Or is that a random?
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Okay.
I think you have that right. He's done it like 24 times in a row, 25 times in a row, something like that. And yeah, so I was watching, funny to you, Scottie Scheffler just being unflappable. I was watching the back nine and Colin Morikawa was kind of in the mix. And there's a couple of moments where for anyone who golfs is like, oh, they're just like us. Like there's a hole where you did not want to hit to the left because you'll go in the water or it'll run into the water. And I just heard him hit. I could just hear an audible like after he had, oh, like he was just so mad. And of course the ball plunks in the water. And then I think he was like in a sand trap, tried to hit out of the sand trap and it fell back in the sand trap, a feeling that I'm very familiar with as a pretty average golfer, but to see these guys play the course, like they never do that. And then Colin Morikawa had a few ones. I was like, man, they're just like me for real. But Scottie Scheffler, I mean, no doubt.
Will humble everybody. Yeah. The Masters humbles everybody. Yeah.
One of my favorite threads is when people cheer for the course. I don't know if you've seen this, like, man, the course did really good today. Like, cause all the golfers did bad. And sort of like people cheering for the course versus the golfers, which is hilarious to me. But anyway, so Scottie Scheffler, had a cool moment. I think this is worth highlighting on the podcast. It's a nice palate cleanser. Jessica, if you want to run the clip for us.
I believe that today's plans were already laid out, you know, many years ago, and I could do nothing to mess up those plans. You know, I've been given a gift of this talent, and I use it for God's glory. That's pretty much it. So when I'm out there, I try to compete to the best of my abilities. Like I said, I really want to win. I feel like that's how I was designed. I've been that way since I was a young kid. That's always been a part of me, and I don't think that should be going away anytime soon. And I don't believe there's anything wrong with that either, but at the end of the day, like I said, my identity's secure already. And I get to come out here and compete, have fun, enjoy it. And then at the end of the day, win or lose, my identity's secure.
Come on now.
Identity politics.
Yep.
My kind of identity politics.
I also thought it was super cool that his wife, he was very open about his wife was expecting and ready to give birth to their first. And if she went into labor, he was out. And people were freaking out like, oh my gosh, how can you leave? How could you like say that? And he was like, nope, this is not what matters. And yeah, I just thought that was such a baller move.
For the first child. And his wife's Catholic actually. So I did a little digging because you had brought up that because he's a Texas boy. You're also in Texas.
Dallas boy.
So he was confirmed for sure because his confirmation sponsor was an agent, I think. And then his wife is Catholic. So he talks like very... I don't mean this as a diss, but like evangelical. So I was like, oh, I didn't know, but he's definitely got some Catholic connections. And I feel like you see something like that. First off, how do you not root for the guy? But what's interesting to me, so I work a lot on like Catholic social media and we have to cover a lot of negative things. And when you get something like that, where it's just so positive, it doesn't even feel like he's doing that much. All he's saying is the obvious truth. Like he's just trying to use God's talents to glorify him. Mm-hmm. Him saying that on such a public platform, it just blew up. So many people liked it. So many people commented. It meant so much to people. And I just wonder if it's because we lack so many of these positive stories now that people just really are just desperate to latch on to some semblance of positivity. That's why I try to include it in the podcast. But man, it's a cool ending to the Masters after just a great event. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because so much of our professional sports is designed around the kind of cult of the personality, you know, whether it's, I call it the LeBron James effect. I feel like ever since his, like, I'm going to South Beach kind of changed everything. But no, we've always had this. And part of it is because of modern marketing and, you know, the attempt to kind of turn people into superheroes because then we'll buy their products and wear their shoes and pretend that we can play as good as them if we do that. But, you know, to see a, you know, superstar. I mean, Scottie Scheffler is like potentially one of the greatest on the path to being one of the greatest golfers ever. I mean, we'll see how many majors and tournaments he ultimately wins, but to deflect in a way, he has his absolute antithesis of ego. And to see people say, it's so refreshing to see someone succeed in their sport and to not make it about themselves. Now, obviously, it's probably not good for marketing if he was, you know, super flamboyant and, you know, bragging, I'm sure his Nike contract would get a little bit larger. But I think, you know, people are, if they just find it so refreshing.
People like him because of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Apart from the faith element, which makes it even better for people like us. I mean, heck, I just watched that again. I'm thinking we should adopt this as our Catholic vote kind of, you know, motto of, God gave us these talents and we're going to use them to the best of our ability. But our ultimate goal is to give glory to him through this work. But heck, that's kind of everyone's vocation if we're thinking about it right.
Yeah. One of my favorite LeBron. Sorry, you brought it up, so I have to talk about it. LeBron just lies on command. Like, I don't know if you've seen some of his biggest lies. It's so funny. But he lied one time about he has books and he'll just have them open to random pages, but he won't be able to tell anyone what the book is about or his favorite part. And one time he was asked about the Godfather movies, like, what was your favorite part? And he's like, it was also good. I can't pick one. Like, he didn't know one line for the Godfather. I'm like, it's just great to hear someone win something, give glory to God, and not just brag or lie about just obvious truths. Yeah. It's like, we've just gotten so used to the LeBron phenomenon. I was like, I got in a long debate about what LeBron has done for PR and sports. I know he just launched that new podcast, so people have been kind of talking about him again. But yeah, we're going to move on before you get LeBron hate.
2 Corinthians moment.
Yeah, right. I know. Okay, so this is
Trump.
This is
Trump had a little bit of a open book, couldn't quite cite his favorite passage, but we'll move on. I know I'm going politics again.
That's a good lesson for all of us to just, if as Catholics, especially because we're Catholics, to have a favorite Bible verse on command. Like, you just need to know one. At least you have to have one on command, because then otherwise Protestants will make fun of you for not.
Yeah, I mean, at least for us Catholics, we kind of related. Like, we hear scripture every Sunday at Mass, and we know we have, you know, there's, you can't not know certain passages, but, you know, we're kind of known for not being scripture first people, even though in our liturgies very much so. But yeah,
you got to have one.
Mine is from when I was at First Communion. I read the reading and I was so nervous about it that I memorized the reading. And so it's like an easy.
Well played.
When you run for president, you at least have that box checked.
Exactly.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of, so I got to give a shout out. And this genuinely obsessed me so much. I've forgotten her name, but I was at a wedding over the weekend and the mother of the groom. So I'm a wedding photographer. My wife has a business. And the mother of the groom said, just offhanded, as I was like trying to gather people for family pictures, said, "Hey, good job on the podcast Friday. Really liked it." And I didn't know she listened at all. So I was like, "Oh man, like, thank you. That's awesome." And then the person she was talking to turned around, got humongous eyes, was like, "Are you Tom from the Loopcast?" And I was like, yes, I'm Tom from the Loopcast. Like, oh my gosh. Like, and her husband pulls me aside, is like, "Listen, I think she spends more time with you than she does with me. Like, she listens to every episode. She's like, I take you when I'm doing laundry. I got this and that."
3 hours a week.
Yeah. So she grabbed a picture and the mother of the groom's like, "He's got to do his job. Like, you got to let him go." And so I like went back. I was like, "Oh, it was so nice to meet you." So shout out to you. That was just a hilarious, like, surreal moment. Of course,
I think you need to like carry some Loop mugs around and show people that you can like autograph them.
No, not like that. I need to bring some like merchandise around to give out to people who recognize and are fans. But shout out to her husband, though. I was at the reception later. He's like, "Hey, do you drink on the job?" And I'm like, "Oh, not usually." He's like, "You got to let me get you a beer." Like, seriously, I got to give you thank you. So I was like, "Oh, thank you. Like, appreciate it." But I turned him down. So shout out to those guys.
They Mom, I'm just so happy that you have become now as famous as Joshua Mercer. Now, he always thought it was him, that it was his, you know, amazing talent. Now we know that. It's actually the Catholic vote platform that makes us all famous.
Yes. And guess what? All glory to God, you know, just trying to use my talents to glorify him. So shout out to Josh too. He is a huge
talent.
That
was a really nice like bow tie to like wrap up the Scotty segment.
And you know, that's podcasting, Kara. Thank you for that alley-oop. I will dunk it. Okay. So we're getting into the meat now. So there's a few, I want to set this up with a few things. We had someone from Arizona email in, distraught about Carrie Lake, which I completely understand. And I want to do her justice because she did a lot of time sending in a lot of research. Phenomenal email from Maria. But there's two clips that I think happened over the weekend that reignited this debate. And this was an episode that got a lot of traction for us. I don't want to be too cute about it. It was Carrie Lake's answer to Arizona's abortion law, basically being left back to the states. It was a law that was created before Arizona was created. And so basically outlawed abortion in the state. Sent people kind of running in a lot of different directions. And Carrie Lake was openly supporting an abortion law. So I want to start first with actually what Bill Maher had to say about it. So if we could run the Bill Maher clip right now, Jessica.
If it's murder, You know, that's why I don't understand the 15-week thing. Or the Trump's plan is, let's leave it to the states. You mean, so killing babies is okay in some states? Like, I can respect the absolutist position. I really can. I scold the left on when they say, oh, you know what? They just hate women. People who aren't pro-life, they pro-choice. They don't hate women. They just made that up. They think it's murder. And it kind of is. I'm just okay with that. I am. I mean, there's 8 billion people in the world. I'm sorry, we won't miss you. That's my position on it. What?
That's quite harsh, Bill.
Yeah, exactly. I'm
not is sure that you're not your position if you're pro-choice?
Isn't that mainly because you don't like children? I mean,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
No. I mean, but if you are, you said you're pro-choice. Mm. That's your position, too. Mm.
Mm. Extraordinary.
Yeah. I don't know if he was expecting like the crowd to cheer for him saying that he thinks it's murder and he's okay with that. But I think that kind of reveals a larger point in that the problem with what happened in Arizona is the obvious from a principle perspective. Okay, so you're pro-life, but you're kind of okay with some murder if it comes at 15 weeks. And we don't have to play the Carrie Lake response video. She made a very glossy response video in which she articulated basically a pro-choice argument from 2008. Saying, I would never choose to do that, but I've talked to people from Arizona and they still, some of them are still
everyone
okay with
has
it.
Different hard circumstances.
Yes, exactly. Some people don't have the right resources. So like we need to have it for some people, which was continually disappointing for a lot of people that I think had a lot of hope for Carrie Lake as a candidate. And so Maria emailed in, and this is where I want to kind of jump off at, because this is what a lot of people are feeling right now. She said, you know, love the show. But I had a tough time listening to your segment on Carrie Lake on Wednesday's episode. I wanted to share some thoughts. To begin, I was upset about Carrie's statement calling on the governor and legislature to allow abortion in Arizona. I wish she had said something like, if Arizona people don't like the old law, they know how to reach their state representatives. The reason I bring it up is because I want to know how we better communicate pro-life policy when the majority of the population wants access to limits to abortion. It seems like any pro-life effort for a total ban goes down in huge flames. It makes it way worse than before. My opinion is organizations like Catholic Vote, 40 Days for Life, etc., need to be unapologetic in their anti-abortion messaging, but it would be largely political suicide to ask our candidates to do so, particularly when the border and economy are such strong issues for us. We can all keep each other locally informed about someone's pro-life views, so don't let our candidates get skewered like poor Blake Masters was by endless liberal advertisements of him saying abortion is satanic sacrifice. He was right, but do you know how well that played to the general public of Arizona? Not well. I would love a deeper dive into the pro-life strategy the way you see it, so please discuss further on the show when time permits and you feel like tackling it some more. Thanks again. God bless, Maria. Shout out to you.
Great comment.
Brian, I'm so interested in what you have to say
Brian,
about this.
I'd love to hear the thoughts.
So many different thoughts. Number one, I was coming back on a plane, so trying to keep up with the latest news with Carrie Lake. I mean, there's so many ways to think about this. Number one, we as Catholics and as decent people can never compromise our fundamental principle. Our goal is to live in a world, whether by law or by habit or tradition, where all children are welcomed into life. From the moment of conception to natural death, every single life has dignity. Now, the question is, how do you do that in a complex world like the United States, where we are now awash in decades of the sexual revolution and all sorts of cultural practices that essentially make that politically exceptionally difficult? You look at these ballot initiatives from Kansas to Michigan to Vermont to Kentucky to Ohio last summer. It is the commenter is right. The public is not ready to outlaw abortion outright. You know, we don't get the Obergefell gay marriage benefit where the court imposed this law on the rest of the country. But one of the advantages they had there is they had a cultural train that was moving in their direction. And we certainly saw it since. And the court helped that train. We have a public that doesn't like abortion, that is willing to limit abortion at some level, whether it's 15 week or, you know, the polling is very different. But now you have the context of an election where the left has essentially framed it as an all or nothing question, either in favor of abortion for any reason, no matter what, no questions asked, or you're in favor of outlawing abortion outright, including rape and incest and everything else. And of course, this game and this construct is disaster politically for people that are pro-life, because we have to try to, in sound bites and in slogans and in advertising, try to explain our position to say, we want all children to be protected, and we're willing to do whatever it takes to get there, even if that means incremental steps to go. So let's get very practical. And this is kind of interesting because the pro-life groups are kind of, you know, talking at each other a little bit about what we think. What is Catholic Vote's position? Our position is this: the 15-week ban or kind of arbitrary lines, and unfortunately create a scenario where we are forced to kind of offer up some moral compromise that has, by the way, zero chance of passing in any in at the federal level. And still allows the left to, I say, keep us in the ban sandbox, where we're forced to argue about limits and regulations. And they're able to frame that as, you just want to ban abortion and you're going to turn back the clock and create this, you know, problem for women. The reason why we have this problem in post-Dobbs, I don't think our movement was quite ready for this, is that the cultural preconditions are not there. And so we're trying to solve essentially decades of cultural consequences with political scalpels. And politics is insufficient to answer this question. And so I will tell you, the conversation we have had with the highest levels of the Trump campaign is this: don't commit publicly to any sort of ban or regulation that essentially is a moral compromise or a surrender. And instead say, the question is not what we're willing to ban. The question is, who are we willing to help? And the posture of the federal government, and there must be a role for the federal government. This is not just a state's issue. That the posture of the federal government can't simply be what we're going to regulate and ban, but what kinds of policies can we put in place, and this is important, to help as many women as possible choose to keep their child. And all the evidence is on our side on this, by the way, where the vast majority of women that have abortions say, if only someone would have offered me an alternative or offered me support or told me it's going to be okay. And I think this is the challenge we have with essentially women who find themselves in a vulnerable position, pregnant, unmarried, whatever it might be. The vast majority of abortions are occurring in this circumstance. And our side simply can't be, just don't abort that child because it's morally wrong. There has to be proportional response on the part of the culture, and this includes the state, by the way, to say, we want you to keep your child. Choosing to keep your child will be a blessing, and we will help you in whatever way you need to keep that child. So what we've told the Trump campaign is they should say, look, the country is divided. We understand this is a difficult political choice, but here's what we're going to do. For the first time ever, we are going to commit equal resources that we spend on advocating and promoting abortion as a government, because we do that. We're going to spend equal resources on the pro-life movement. We're talking billions of dollars. We're going to spend that money subsidizing crisis pregnancy care centers, adoption and alternatives to abortion.
I think we're losing him.
Yeah. Hey, Brian, hold up. We're losing you, brother. Let's see. I'm going to mute him until he comes back. Karen.
I hate when internet does that.
I was in my head. I was like, Brian is cooking. I prayed to St. Michael to protect the stream and had a little bit too much work. Okay, wait. He's back. Okay.
So, yeah, I'm making like these great points, and this, the internet gods just.
Evil.
Mm-hmm. I literally was like, there's something going on. Same Michael, protect the stream. Something okay, welcome on. Back. Sorry. Brian, before you keep going though, can you put into perspective, you just said spend equally. And I don't think people understand how much tax money is spent to promote abortion, whether or not explicitly in terms of going to Planned Parenthood, but also in indirect ways, encouraging things that lead to abortion. So can you be explicit? What would that look like in a ballpark? Like how much money and how game changing would that be?
This is something we're working on right now. You know, what happened after the Dobbs decision is the Biden administration essentially told every executive agency. I mean, we're talking about things that you wouldn't think, not just Health and Human Services, every agency possible, to use discretionary funds that they have to alter policy and to adjust, to promote, access, publicize, and to essentially elevate the right to abortion. And I think our side, because of some of the limited government kind of wing to we can't spend money because we don't have money, to, well, we don't want to get the government involved in all these sorts of private affairs because then we're going to be enslaved to government money and they'll start to regulate us. You know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars that are available right now that if a president is elected, he could unlock for the pro-life movement. And no strings attached, by the way. And obviously the left is going to fight this, but we're going to say, look, if you're going to be spending all this money on abortion, why can't we be spending the same amount of money, not on stopping abortion directly, because of course, some of that can get complicated, but on promoting the efforts to help women to choose life.
Go ahead, Kara.
I was just going to say, so is your point essentially that we need to have a more culture, pro-life culture, and in order to do that, we have to be on offense with, and use federal dollars to do that?
Here's my point. We're not against abortion just because it's a moral evil and it's a tragedy. We're against abortion because of what we're for. And our policy and our politics need to emphasize as much of what we're for as much as we do in terms of what we're against. And when we talk about, well, it's a states' rights issue and the federal government needs to stay out. No, the federal government needs to be involved. The question is, what kind of federal policy can we get through and can make a meaningful difference in reducing, if not setting us on a path to ultimately getting rid of abortion altogether? And this whole kind of culture is downstream from politics debate the right has had for so many years. We fail to take account of the ways in which federal policy, federal money, federal pressure actually shapes those cultural conditions. And we need to recognize that we have to address that cultural problem we're in, where so many women, even women that don't like abortion and the polling saying they're disgusted by it, but they're not willing to act in the voting booth to meaningfully limit, if not ban it all outright, they're still stuck with this kind of cultural sensibility that we need abortion for some reason, because there's cases in which women might find themselves the Carrie Lake essentially outlining it. And we have to go right at that prejudice, because that's where the left is winning. They're not just winning because they're spending more money and outfoxing us on messaging at the ballot booth. They're winning because they have established a bunch of cultural prejudices in their favor. And we need to be unafraid to use the state to go after that and to elevate our argument about, you know, why having a child is not the most terrible thing that can happen. Now, there's a bunch of studies on this that I've read recently about how women see if they find themselves pregnant and they want to get an abortion because they feel like pregnancy ruins their life, that their life is over. The life that they thought they were going to have, and they find themselves pregnant, that their life is over. And why is that? It's because the left has told women that the worst possible thing that could ever happen to you is to have a baby. You know, and now they say it destroys the environment.
Not part of my plan.
Now they say exactly. I need to focus on myself. We have to lean into, in fact, aggressively promote a different way of understanding the gift of life. I'm not saying that that's the only thing, that we shouldn't work eventually towards some kind of policies to limit abortion. But in this electoral cycle, my advice to candidates is stop taking the media debate and talking about what you're willing to ban and start talking about who you're willing to help. I can guarantee you that's like an 80-20 issue. You know, I told the Trump campaign, I'll tell you this, what he needs to announce is an America First big, beautiful baby boom. Because it's not just about the moral questions around abortion. It's also about our survival as a country. We're not having enough babies. In a country that's not having babies is a country that's dying. Go ask Japan. Go ask Western Europe.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to on that demographic death spiral if we didn't have immigration. And it actually is an easy way for Trump to talk about the things he likes to talk about. While we're importing all these labor that from people who don't share our values and they're coming over illegally, and we need to prioritize the lives of Americans, and we need to reindustrialize the United States. Well, good luck reindustrializing the United States if you're not having babies. Mm-hmm. Those workers have to come somewhere. And so there's an economic case, there's a moral case, there's a huge need to speak to the hearts and I think instincts of these suburban women voters that are being pulled by the Democrats out of their, you know, Republican voting habits. You know, there's a shift occurring. And to say, I have your back, and I understand this is a difficult choice, but if you find yourself in these circumstances, we want to come alongside you and help you. And the federal government is committed, not as the federal government, some new big entitlement program. It needs to invest in the private sector that is already there. Now, our pregnancy resource centers are on the front lines already, but let's face it, they do not have the resources to compete with the other side. And right. I think this is a way that for, you know, in this election cycle, we can talk about how actually who truly cares about women. If your only choice is to abort that child and get back to work, which is what the left is essentially telling women, to that deep sensibility that women have about the value of their body and of a child that they bear. Mm-hmm. We need to go to the heart of that. And I think some of the moral righteousness argument versus, you know, pro-abortion, shout my abortion dynamic fails to address these women that are in the middle of this equation.
Yeah. And it really feels like it's not my soapbox. Yeah.
No, that's super interesting. I think that you're essentially saying like we should subsidize from the federal government or even state government. Like, for example, if Carrie Lake were to talk about this, like, why wouldn't she say, if you elect me as your senator, I will do X, Y, Z instead of focusing on the 2008, everyone's in different situations and circumstances. I get that this is a hard choice. And this is why, if I'm elected your senator, I will make sure that we unlock funds or whatever. Or even pointing out that her opponent is ready for infanticide, essentially, like after birth. Like, it seems like that would be a really awesome position for senators or people who are up for election all over the country, including Trump.
And I want to give Carrie Lake a little bit of credit, because in that same video, she was talking about going to Hungary and doing the tax incentives basically for having children. So she's almost there. Like, she was close. It just feels like she did not need to concede the earlier part of like, well, I'm kind of, kind of pro-life.
I want to say something else about this too, because it's, you know, bring up Hungary and you bring up, okay, we're going to lean into spending government money on helping women. The evidence in Hungary, by the way, is not that if you do some kind of baby bonus thing that now people start having a lot more children. In fact, it's not, there's not really a direct relationship to the expense and the actual outcome. I'll tell you what it does change, though. It changes the cultural kind of phenomenon, because it says, the state says that having a baby is a good thing, a beautiful thing. It's good for the country. It's good for the community. It's good for the culture. And what the subsidies are is not necessarily, and the left, by the way, has found this out well over the last several decades. It's not as much that you're funding your cultural priorities, is that you're establishing new norms and ways of thinking about your cultural priorities that people inherit, even if they're not directly taking a check or making a decision in the context of whether or not they're going to get some tax credit if they have a baby.
Yeah. Like, it's not effective enough to change the culture. Yeah. So, Kara, I'm just curious too, from your perspective, like, it's easy to talk from a deep policy thing, but as a woman, and as someone, you knew, Maria, you've met.
I've met Maria.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to people in Arizona hey, Maria, but from a female perspective, from a messaging or on a personal level, how effective has like the current divide been, I guess, for
it's super interesting, because I think you guys talked last week on the Loopcast about the article from the Washington Post where baby Olivia, and I thought that article was so fascinating because the gal that was in it literally bought into everything that the culture tells you. You can't have a baby. I don't have funds for this. And by the end of the article, you see that the baby has been she's got a relationship with the baby, went to her first birthday, and it's a blessing that she never knew could exist in her life. And I think that that's so awesome to hear stories about that. And I wish that there were more, like, it almost seems like the right needs to do more of that, more of talking about this is how we're helping, or instead of just focusing on not murdering babies in the womb or executing them, as Trump said the other day. I think stories like that would be awesome and also help show that it's not just, from a woman's perspective, it's almost like you need to focus on the woman and not the baby. And that's a really simple, like almost dumb thing to say. But when you're in that moment, I've never been in that moment, but I can only imagine that you're in that moment. You're scared and you're thinking about yourself.
People lose that. You're saying it's obvious, but people lose that, especially on online debates. People just love to hash out the morality, but like, we're almost forgetting at the heart of it. What is it? It's a human problem. It's not just a baby or a mom, or it's all separate. Like, this is a human problem we all deal with in the human experience. And one thing that's interesting too, if you want to tie it back to like on a policy or politics level, the one thing that changes people's voting records significantly immediately is becoming a mother. It's becoming a father, is having a family. Like, your perspective immediately changes. So if we can create that, like as Brian was saying, the opportunities to become a mother or a father, culturally encouraging that, from a government level encouraging that, people's perspectives will change immediately. I'm sure whoever this mother did who bought into all these things now has the child, now sees it, now is living that life. I know it's not ideal because it's an adoption, but even so, she's changed forever. There's no going back.
Exactly. And she wants to be better. She wants to finish school. Right. She wants to. And that was what was so interesting about the Bill Maher piece, is that he was honest about it. He's like, look, it is murder. And it's he was very honest about the brutal reality of what it is, and just owned,
He said something that's just, you're apparently not allowed to say, because I don't think I've ever heard it articulated like that on that large of a platform. From someone, I think he's like a libertarian. I don't know what he considers himself these days, but it's the truth. And it's odd how we've all been psyoped into not adopt, like the left has all been told, like rank and file, don't use that language. Don't use that language. Don't say it. Don't say it. We all have these weird euphemisms for what it really is. But to hear it admitted like that, I think really puts the conversation in perspective.
Well, and think about what Bill Maher's really saying. He's saying, look, if we really are honest with ourselves, abortion ends the life of a child. And he says, I'm good with that. Why? Because he doesn't have an answer to what we do with women who find themselves in difficult circumstances that believe it's the end of their life. That's the opening the pro-life movement needs to use. We need to start saying, well, wait a minute, Bill, what if we were to make it possible for a woman who finds herself in that circumstance where her life isn't over and it's not the worst thing that could ever happen to you? And we actually say as a country, we want your child. We need your child. Your child is a unbelievable gift. And it's not going to ruin your life. And if you choose to not keep your child, give it up for adoption. And we will make it possible and make it easier for you to do that. There's, you know, a way in which the pro-abortion movement, you know, remember they were pro-choice for so long, safe, legal, and rare, and pro-choice.
Right.
We've let them slide into only one choice. They're not a pro-choice movement. They're a one choice, one solution, one size fits all. And we need to start speaking directly to, I think, this kind of gut instincts that the majority of women, now you're not the hardcore pro-abortion kind of caucus is not going to, we don't need their votes. Sure. We need those women in the middle that find themselves.
Say Michael.
And he's out.
Brian's been, this is, someone's messing with the lever somewhere, I think.
Exactly. I totally agree with what he's saying. I think it's very interesting. And I would love to see, we've got Mother's Day coming up next month. I would love to see more pieces like this. I think it's also interesting because young women who are making these decisions, they're not reading blog posts, or they're not reading the Washington Post or these like main articles. All this this conversation happens on places that like TikTok or whatnot. You've got all these short little videos or whatnot of people giving their opinions. Or it's a cultural moment. And I even remember like after Roe was overturned, everybody all over social media, like people that I've never talked politics with before, you knew everybody's opinion on what happened.
Oh, yeah.
I wish that would be awesome to see more people promoting life in those instances.
Yeah. To take back who cares about women.
Exactly.
For sure. Sorry we lost Brian. Glad you're back. I think Brian, I'll give you a closing statement, but we got to move into the Twilight Zone.
Oh boy. Okay. Oh, closing statement. My closing statement would be, this is a message to every politician out there. If asked about what you're willing to ban, tell them the question is not what I'm willing to ban. The question is who I'm willing to help. And I am committed to marshaling every resource of the government at the state or federal level to helping as many women as possible keep their child.
There we go.
Boom.
I think that was it right there. But we slide into the Twilight Zone now. Kara, you're up first.
Okay. It was a hard decision this week, but one that really got me laughing and just like, what world are we living in? Is there was an illegal immigrant that came here from Venezuela, and he wound up in Sandusky, Ohio. Guy doesn't speak any English. And so he decides that he's going to try to rob a bank, but he uses Google Translate to try to do it. So you can see in the video that we have of him sitting in, walking into the bank and sitting there and showing his phone to a person at the desk, basically, you know, using Google Translate to say, I'm robbing you, put all the money in a bag sort of thing.
Could you imagine like what's got to be going through your head to go to a foreign country to sit down a place you don't speak the language to then rob a bank? But like, you know, modern technology just continues to marvel
that he has a phone and he has Google Translate.
Probably given to him by someone at the border. Yeah. Oh my gosh, man. Should have just gone to Six Flags.
I mean, he could have used some Duolingo on that phone and been able to learn how to use speak English.
So the element of the story is I think it took him so long that police got there because he was like taking too long with Google Translate. The police were able to get there in time because he couldn't speak the language. He couldn't communicate what he wanted. So, you know,
he comes to the country. He comes to our country, gets clothes, gets somehow shipped to Sandusky, Ohio. And now he's robbing us.
Yeah, because no one intentionally ends up in Sandusky, Ohio. That's what's crazy about this is like they for sure bust him to somewhere in the Midwest. Like,
exactly. So funny. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I have anything more to add on. That's pretty insane, Kara. Okay, so Brian, you're up next.
So I don't know if I always get this Twilight Zone thing right. So it's supposed to be like something funny, something like random. I kind of have two things. My first thing is this. I was in Rome last week. You walk around the city of Rome, and of course you see St. Peter's and the grandeur of St. Peter's. But there's something else that's hard not to miss, and that is a line almost halfway around waiting to get in to see St. Peter's. And it just as a reminder to me, and I'm sure, and oh, by the way, if you want to know the secret, there's actually a prayer entrance that's on the right side if you're just going to pray. Basically, like if you're, you know, a practicing Catholic,
right, if you're actually Catholic,
the secret handshake, you can get in there. But it was such a testament to the power of our church to teach even with beauty. That these, you know, tourists from around the world, and they're all these different languages, these people waiting in line to see a place of worship that lifts, you can't help, but lifts every part of their being to the transcendent, which is what good architecture and good liturgy is supposed to do. The other Twilight Zone thing I'll say is I saw on the way back on the plane, some recent polling that showed which candidate is the most popular candidate right now running for president. You know who it is?
Is it RFK?
It's RFK. Mm-hmm. RFK now just edged out Trump. 47% of voters have a positive opinion out of him. And I think Robert F. Kennedy is going to be a bigger factor than a lot of people realize. He's polling in the high teens. Now, let's see if he holds that. Let's see if he can get on the ballot in a lot of these places. But I'll do a little Catholic vote secret. We are having conversations with RFK, not because we're going to endorse him. Don't think that, but because I think his voice is very important, particularly blunting some of this extreme pro-abortion rhetoric coming out of the left. And Robert F. Kennedy's an interesting guy. He's pro-abortion. I've argued directly with him about it, but he is open to some of these arguments that we've been talking about the need to try to help women to keep their children. And I think the more voices we can get saying that, the more we can contrast the kind of crazy left-wing extremism of Biden, but also try to push Trump in the direction of to say that you can't wash your hands of this issue. And so keep an eye on RFK. I think he's going to be a pretty big factor here come November.
If I could ask, is so there's the numbers illustrate to me there's something beyond just I don't like either candidate, right? Just like kind of distaste in each candidate. So what about RFK specifically then do you think is so compelling enough to make him the most popular candidate right now, according to polling?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of both candidates are distasteful to a certain, you know, segment of the electorate. There's no question there's some of that. There's also people who want medical freedom around vaccines, and they see Big Pharma as a threat. They see Big Pharma connected to a larger globalist kind of regime that wants to manage us all. I certainly share that concern. Yep, sure. Obviously, he has very strong, you know, passion for the environment. And I think a lot of people that have found, you know, on the left that have found Biden inadequate there. I think it's a lot of just here's a guy who's trying to solve problems and he's very honest. He just says what he thinks and he's wrong on a bunch of things. And I've privately confronted him on a lot of that. But the fact that he will have a conversation with me several times, by the way, and we will talk through and we will argue about these things. I can't get Joe Biden or Donald Trump directly on the phone.
Yeah.
But I think he's intriguing to people. And, you know, to the extent the kind of two-party system is trapped with in the way that it is, I think it may speak to the possibility. I know Josh Mercer will disagree with me on this, but it may speak to the possibility of third party candidates in the future. You know, you only need 34% and you can win. And so it's not out of the question that we're seeing kind of a shift occurring historically in this country. And we'll see how this plays out.
Do you think people who are more like old school Democrat are enticed by what he's saying?
The name.
That's not where he's getting votes right now. He's getting votes primarily among young people and among Latinos, which is the two constituencies he's dominating with. It is an interesting question, particularly for us, are, you know, kind of social justice Catholics, can, you know, intrigued by him enough where they would not vote for Trump, but vote for RFK. Certainly that will help Trump. Right now, we're seeing in the polling, by the way, RFK is taking a slight more Biden voters than he is Trump voters. And so if that were to occur, it may come down to, you know, 1 or 2% of the RFK factor that decides the election.
Well, the social justice warrior Catholics are also like quadruple boosted and wearing a mask. So I don't think they're big fans of RFK, if I had to guess. All right, so I got to slide mine in here at the end. So we did this one's a little bit of a saga. So we did a long segment on NPR. So there was someone within NPR that basically came out and said what everyone understands to be true. NPR completely changed in character during Trump, and then the backbreaker was George Floyd. So I think they had 86 editors, 86 to zero, all Democrats. I mean, what everyone kind of knows to be true, but NPR was definitely in a bad spot. So they've lost a lot of listenership. They're very much struggling. They needed a new CEO. So the consensus was maybe NPR will do the smart thing, try to clean house a little bit, you know, change their ideological lines, maybe not be so ideological, maybe come a little bit more to the center. Be a little bit more neutral. And I'm happy to report, no, that's not what they did. They took the absolute opposite approach. So the new CEO, I have some fun tweets, but her name is Catherine Maher. She's a white person who hates white people. Imagine that. So
does she identify as not white?
I don't know, which is hilarious because, you know, the only people that listen to NPR are white people, which is kind of hilarious, like that we'd be insulting the listenership like that. But I have some old tweets from her here. So and you could slide over to that one. I think it's in the show notes, but I'll read them off. I know that hysteric white woman voice. I was taught to do it. I've done it. It's disturbing recognition. While I don't recall ever using it to deliberately expose another person to immediate physical harm on my own cognizance, it's not impossible. That is whiteness.
Wow.
Gotta love the racism.
Yeah. Oh, here's one of my favorites. And I'm white, so my hair doesn't automatically carry with it the freight of my race, worth, and everyone else's encoded assumptions and biases.
What?
And then here's the kicker. Sure, looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about protests not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, not a huge fan of white people. She also talked to Trevor Noah on the Daily Show about expanding Wikipedia's editor base beyond white men. She's coming over from Wikimedia. So I'm happy to report that NPR will probably continue to go down the drains here. But we got a cool email from someone who was a former listener. So we have from Susie and Brian. What's up, guys? I have recently become a regular listener of the Loopcast. I've been a subscriber to the Loop email about 4 years. Very much enjoy your podcast. I wanted to pass along that after hearing your show, when you talked about NPR and their very liberal bias, I canceled my monthly support. I haven't listened to NPR in a very long time. The monthly support was one of those things that just happened automatically. This was a great reminder to reassess where our charitable donation dollars go. We are monthly supporters of Catholic Vote. And I will continue to share with my friends and family here in Iowa about the good work you are doing and encourage them to listen, learn, and grow into their faith and knowledge. Blessings, Susie. So shout out to Susie. Glad we could knock you off the NPR train. I think it was about time. But yeah, if you want to help out Catholic Vote here, Brian and Kara can speak to this. The only way we're able to do literally anything we do, especially this podcast, is due to the generosity of our supporters. So if you want to support the program, loopcast.org is where you can help that out. You'll find it in the description as well. I mean, you guys are speaking to donors all the time. Hopefully they like the Loopcast. But if you could just speak to a little bit of our relationship with some of these donors and how they power what we have going on.
Go for it, Brian.
Well, I mean, I have the kind of privilege of trying to talk to our highest and best donors because they want to talk to the guy at the top and they think, you know, that I have something intelligent to say. But I will just say this. People are thirsting for answers to the kind of anxiety that we're all feeling. And what I like to tell our team and the kind of things we work on is we're not just here to talk. And the Loopcast is obviously a talk show, but the Loopcast is at the service of action. Catholic Vote is not a talking kind of issue press releases and hope things get better organization. We are an organization founded on making change, bringing about change. And so the Loopcast, obviously we get to come on here and do this, but you know, all props to all the people behind us that are working out in the field, working in states right now, working on all of the policy, lobbying on the Hill, litigating in the courts, signing up voters to vote, all those kinds of, all that. That's the meat of Catholic Vote. And that's really where your support not only just comes in and allows us to have this conversation, but goes to the front lines to keep the work that we're doing possible. Because we don't make any changes, you know, we'll be talking this country down the dustbin.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I think it's important too, because you see, I talk to people all over the, well, mainly the West Coast, but there are folks that do the same, what I do, all throughout the country. And nobody knows where to get good quality information. And so that's one of the things that the Loop and the Loopcast does is there's conversations that are happening in the doctor's office, at your neighborhood block party, or, you know, anywhere that you people really congregate at, in the church, in churches. And they don't know, no one, it, or people are struggling with how to talk about these issues. And I think that's one of the things that the Loop and the Loopcast really provides people. Ways to talk about the issues and from a Catholic perspective, because this is who we are at our core. And I think that's, and it's important, and it's an important service that
we're doing. You know, I agree. We need to stop asking for permission to be a part of the conversation. Catholics have the unbelievable richness of our faith and the vision of our faith and the beauty of our faith. We have the answers. Let's go take it to the world. Let's figure out how to get it to the front lines and to get as many people as possible to listen, because we're not some interest group over on the side that's trying to do, you know, kind of things at the margins. We should be at the center of civilization as we have been, and we need the church to embrace that responsibility again and have the courage to tell the world what it is we believe and why it is that we
just like the apostles. We have to think about our mission the same way.
Very apostolic. So who better to do all of that than have Brian and Kara on the Loopcast? Thank you so much, guys, for coming on. This is a little bit of a, you know, engagement here. If you guys want to have them back on, ways you can help the program, go leave us a comment, Apple Podcasts. Tell them you love Brian and Kara. Tell them you love the show. 5 stars. You can send us 5 stars on Spotify. You can email me, loopcast@catholicvote.org. You can drop it in the comments here on the YouTube video. Subscribe, like it. We appreciate it. Share it around. These are all ways that you can help the show in the immediate term. But we're praying for you. Catholic Vote, little secret as well. We have a weekly rosary here internally. We pray for all of the donors. We pray for all the people that interact with the Loop, all the loopers, loopcasters. So we're praying for you. Ask that you pray for us. And we will see you guys on Wednesday. St. Thomas More, St. Fidelis, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Pray for us. We'll see you guys on the next one.
Pray for us.
Peace.